It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And we're going to start out by saying that it would be a good thing to have a pencil and paper handy, because you never know when something's going to come up that you're going to want to write down some information that, you might want to act on later. Email address, website, maybe a telephone number, someplace you want to be someday. That'd be a good thing. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz on the 9th of July. Let's get started. Sea Shepherd is going to pay $2.55 million in a whaling contempt dispute. This story from the Environment News Service. Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, a U.S. nonprofit marine conservation group, will pay two Japanese entities $2.55 million to resolve a legal dispute over whaling in the Southern Ocean. Last December, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society founder Paul Watson and the former directors were found in civil contempt of a temporary injunction issued by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2012, ordering Sea Shepherd vessels to stay 500 yards away from Japanese whaling vessels in the Southern Ocean. In exchange for the $2.55 million payment to Japan's nonprofit Institute for Cetacean Research and for profit Kyoto Senpaku, they will dismiss their action for more than $4.1 million in damages relating to contempt and drop all claims against the former Sea Shepherd Board of Directors, all parties announced on Monday. The nonprofit's Japanese Institute for Cetacean Research, or ICR, conducts lethal whaling for research purposes, and Kyoto Senpaku, a for-profit company, conducts the collection, processing, and selling of whale products on behalf of the ICR. The two Japanese organizations said in a statement, Sea Shepherd admitted in court that the vessels Steve Irwin, Bob Barker, San Simon, and Bridget Bardot all breached the 500-yard perimeter established by the court. The settlement figure of $2.55 million was agreed to in negotiations among the parties that have taken place since the court's ruling on December 19th of 2014. Sea Shepherd says funding for the settlement will come from money from other legal actions and settlements and will not include funds from donors. Sea Shepherd does not agree with the Ninth Circuit's holding that it was in contempt, but after more than 2 years of litigation, we are very pleased to be putting the contempt action behind us, said Claire Lobes Davis, Sea Shepherd's legal counsel and partner at Lane Powell, a Pacific Northwest law firm. The temporary injunction was issued on the eve of Sea Shepherd's Operation Zero Tolerance campaign that planned to intervene against ICR's whaling in the Southern Ocean during the 2012-2013 winter season. In response, Sea Shepherd withdrew from Operation Zero Tolerance and all future Southern Ocean whale protection campaigns, but those campaigns continued under the leadership of independent foreign groups such as Sea Shepherd Australia. ICR filed a motion for contempt in early 2013, and after an eight-day trial, an appellate commissioner recommended that neither Sea Shepherd nor any of its affiliates be found in contempt. But in December of 2014, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals disregarded this recommendation and found Sea Shepherd, Watson, and the former members of the Sea Shepherd Board of Directors in contempt of the injunction based on the actions of foreign groups. ICR is still seeking a permanent injunction against Sea Shepherd in the U.S. District Court in Seattle to keep Sea Shepherd, Paul Watson, and any person acting in concert with them from approaching within 500 yards of vessels operated by ICR and KS on the high seas of the Southern Ocean, physically attacking them or interfering with their safe navigation, or for raising money for those activities. In a related development, the U.S. Supreme Court on June 8th rejected a request by Sea Shepherd to review the Ninth Circuit contempt decision. Sea Shepherd is continuing its own legal actions against Japanese whaling in the Southern Ocean. Attorney Lobes Davis said the group seeks to expose ICR's dangerous and illegal activities in the Southern Ocean, including the violent actions taken against those who have tried to stop it from killing whales in violation of international law. In a case set for trial in the fall of 2016, Sea Shepherd is seeking a declaration that ICR's whaling in the Southern Ocean is illegal under international law. The group seeks an injunction preventing ICR from using violent or dangerous tactics to protect its illegal activities. Sea Shepherd is also asking the district court to award damages for ICR's deliberate ramming of the Sea Shepherd vessel 80 Gill in 2019 in an action that destroyed the small, fast vessel. It is crucial that Sea Shepherd be able to support its direct action campaigns on the seas with forceful action in the courts against those who plunder the world's oceans in violation of international law, said Sea Shepherd founder and Captain Paul Watson. We never expected our efforts to stop illegal whaling in the Southern Ocean to be easy. After all, we have been challenging one of the world's economic superpowers for over a decade, Watson said. Continuing, we weathered the violence directed at us by the whalers. We weathered the storms, the ice, the politics, and the legal assaults directed at us, said Watson. In the end, we prevailed where it was most important, in the fact that thousands of whales that would otherwise be dead are alive and free in the Southern Ocean, and Japanese whaling has been internationally exposed as an illegal operation by both the International Court of Justice and the International Whaling Commission. The ongoing legal dispute arises from Japan's long-running violation of the International Whaling Commission's global ban on commercial whaling, established in 1986. Since 1987, Japan has granted scientific research permits for Japanese organizations to kill whales and sell their meat on the commercial market. In recent years, these permits have allowed the ICR to kill more than 1,000 whales in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary each year, including minke, humpback, and endangered fin whales, although Sea Shepherd says its interference campaigns have saved many thousands of those whales. Last year, the International Court of Justice declared Japan's research rationale to be a sham and ruled that Japanese whale hunts violate international law. And moving to Ontario, Canada, intruders release 6,800 mink from St. Mary's Farm in a story from CBC News as found on the Earth First Newswire. Ontario Provincial Police are investigating a break-in at a fur farm north of St. Mary's, which led to the release of 6,800 mink from their cages Tuesday night. Kirk Rankin, president of RBR Fur Farm, said he went to work this morning and discovered mink running around all over the place. "I'm fed up," said Rankin. "Brain-dead people who apparently don't like what I do for a living. My grandfather started this farm in 1937. Maybe I don't like what some people, what they do either, but it doesn't give me the right to go and try and put them out of business or do something stupid." Rankin said he's been rounding up mink by hand using fishnets and gloves. He has not been able to count how many have been returned to their cages and how many are still missing. "They let out all the young ones. Right now it doesn't look too bad, but we haven't got it all lined up to know how many have been caught yet," says Rankin. Police said several wide openings were cut in the fence that surrounds the farm on Road 125. Four sheds were broken into sometime between 11 p.m. Tuesday and 1 a.m. Wednesday. This is the second break-in of a commercial mink farm near St. Mary's in recent months. The first was at Glenwood Fur Farms on Perth Line 9 at the end of May, when 1,600 mink were released. Most were captured and returned, but roughly 100 died from exposure to the cold, injuries from fighting, or being squashed on the road. And in Turkey, environmentalists block a road to a mining company in this story by Adem Güngör of the Hürriyet Daily News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A group of locals and environmental activists blocked the road to an untouched forested area in the Black Sea province of Artvin to prevent the activities of a mining firm. Activists and locals guard the mountainous forests of Artvin in separate locations to prevent forestry ministry officials from entering the area. Artvin Forestry Ministry officials, however, aim to enter the area in order to make calculations to complete the procedures for a firm to start its work in the area. Ministry officials attempted to enter the area on a different path after a previous attempt was stopped by the activist roadblock. Local activists who organized themselves via social media in a short time gathered in the Kara Tepe neighborhood, which is located at an altitude of 1,800 meters. That's about 5,000 feet. They moved trees cut by forestry officials to the road and blocked traffic, stopping the entry of the officials. They have taken pictures with the tree barricades they have made and shared them with social media. One is shown on the page. Looks like a happy bunch of people blocking a road. The group calls itself 300 Sarah Tepeli in reference to the legend of 300 Spartans who stood their ground against the Persians, immortalized in the movie 300. They are determined at all costs to block any possible construction and mining work in the area. Green Artvin Association's head Nur Nessi Karahan said they had to walk the whole way to the forest area because it was blocked in several locations. The road was blocked due to the collapse in the tunnel. We had to walk 3 kilometers around it. We came across the firm's vehicle as they were not using the well-known road anymore. They said officials from the firm will come here and we are determined to wait here to talk to them, said Karahan. Hakan Akin, a shopkeeper in Artvin, said it is a promising development for him to see so many people gather in an area minutes after they heard rumors the firm would start work there. The experts said this area is not suitable for mining. We're the locals here. We already told them that it is not possible for them to operate here. This place is our green. This is where we live. We have given enough to the dams. We will no longer allow any more construction, said Akin. Among the group, Hassan Yüksel, a member of Green Artvin Association, said they will continue to hold their posts on multiple roads in the Sarah Tepe neighborhood to prevent the entry of mining firms. They are wrong to think we will give up. They will come across an Artvin local on every corner of these trees whenever they come here, said Yüksel. Main opposition Republican People's Party provincial branch head Ali Yusel Kurt also held a meeting in the area. He claimed that some people were also burning the vehicles in order to provoke locals by blaming the locals for the arson. We completely deny such claims, said Kurt. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services has denied the reclassification of wolves in this story from Northland's News Center, as found on the Earth First Newswire. An attempt to reclassify wolves from endangered to less protected status of threatened has failed. A proposal by the Humane Society of the United States and 21 other conservation and wolf protection organizations offered a pathway for compromise between the more current restrictive endangered listing for wolves in the Great Lakes and Wyoming and the efforts by some politicians in Congress to strip wolves of all protections. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service rejected the petition on Tuesday. The threatened listing would have continued federal oversight and funding of wolf recovery efforts, but it would have also given federal, state, and local wildlife managers more flexibility to address specific wolf conflicts, such as livestock depredation. Michael Kargarian, Chief Program and Policy Officer of the Humane Society of the United States, issued the following statement. We are disappointed in the Fish and Wildlife Service's decision not to consider this middle ground approach to wolf management. A threatened listing is a reasonable compromise to this contentious issue, and it retains some federal protection for wolves while providing more flexibility to the states in dealing with the occasional problem wolf. And 139 have been arrested in a historic wildlife crime operation. This story from the Environment News Service. The largest ever coordinated international law enforcement operation against illegal trade in endangered species has resulted in 139 arrests and more than 247 seizures, including elephant ivory, rhino horns, pangolins, tortoises, rosewood, and medicinal plants, officials revealed. Operation Cobra 3, conducted in two phases between mid-March and the end of May, drew the cooperative participation of law enforcement teams and agencies from 62 countries in Europe, Africa, Asia, and America. Key successes during the operation included the arrest of a Chinese national believed to have been coordinating rhino horn smuggling from Namibia, the arrest of a notorious elephant poacher in India, and the seizure of 340 elephant tusks and 65 rhino horns in Mozambique. Over 50,000 illegal wildlife items were seized in the United Kingdom, as well as 10,000 in Austria, 5,000 in Germany, including large amounts of illegal supplement capsules containing wildlife products. In total, 37 countries reported seizures and/or arrests. Large numbers of illegal items were seized in China, Singapore, and South Africa. The operation was organized by the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Wildlife Enforcement Network, ASEAN-WEN, and the Lusaka Agreement Task Force. It was supported by numerous international agencies and organizations such as Interpol and Europol. During Operation Cobra 3, Thai Customs made one of the biggest seizures of elephant ivory in its history, over 4 tons. The ivory was hidden in containers originating in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and was en route to Laos. A week later, Thai Customs seized 3.1 tons of elephant tusks from Kenya. The 511 pieces seized, worth $6 million or 5.3 million euros, were hidden in sacks of tea in containers also bound for Laos. As a result, a criminal network involved in the illegal trade of elephant ivory from Kenya to Laos was identified, and several suspects were arrested. Investigations are still ongoing. Operation Cobra 3 is a great example of the collaboration that is needed between multiple organizations, disciplines, and agencies to combat organized transnational wildlife crime, said John Scanlon, Secretary General of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES. It is most encouraging to see enforcement agencies working together across source, transit, and destination states to combat these serious wildlife crimes, which make it increasingly likely that these illicit activities will be detected and criminals behind them brought to justice, said Scanlon. Europol supported the operation by facilitating information exchange and coordinating the activities of police, customs, forestry, and other law enforcement authorities from 25 of the 28 member EU states. Europol Director Rob Wainwright said, "Trafficking of endangered species remains a problem in the EU and beyond. It is often underestimated and not given the recognition or priority it deserves. Poaching and the illegal trade in species are dominated by organized crime groups who operate worldwide and make huge profits from these activities." European seizures included 11,439 dead and live specimens, almost 2,000 parts and products, and over 6 tons of timber, plants, and animal parts. Officials intercepted and seized 20 kilograms of live leeches and 25 kilograms of coral in Bulgaria, 10,000 dead seahorses and over 400 live turtles in the United Kingdom, and another 300 in Croatia, over 90 kilograms of coral and more than 50 kilograms of animal heads, horns, and other parts in Spain, more than 500 kilograms of frozen eel in Poland, over 800 cacti in a joint German-Chinese operation, 16 whale ribs in the Netherlands, and 50 kilograms of raw, unworked ivory in France. Posted on the Earth First RRR message from Craig Lewis Sturr. Warmest spiritual greetings. Please know that the Earth First Round River Rendezvous held in Vermont's Green Mountains on Romance Mountain next to a blueberry management area was an intense 8 days from July 1st to the 8th. Arriving in the rain with my neo-pagan friends, the Novak family farmers from Massachusetts, we set up tents in the woods above the main fire circle and tarped workshop areas. I volunteered with the Seeds of Peace Eastern Kitchen and bottom-lined the pots and pans dishes washing pit, while not chopping vegetables for 3 daily meals, serving a peak of 300 Earth Firsters, assorted generic anarchists, and the general public who attended. The week was characterized by intense soul-searching in regard to racial issues, Native American colonization issues, transsexual gay lifestyles, and to what extent Earth First has succeeded or failed in realizing a necessary diverse movement identity over the past 4 decades. Regardless of the heated debates, the February 2016 Earth First Organizers Conference will not be held in Oakland. The week was educational for all, mostly intelligent and respectful, not fully satisfying for everyone. Yet the Earth First Green Mountain Vermont host group was gracious in spite of receiving a disproportionate amount of criticism for the gatherings not appearing more like a world social forum. I'm not sure what that means exactly. After the Rundi action took place at three locations, to see the photos, please go to the Earth First Newswire on the Internet. Thank you, Craig, for that report. Hopefully we'll get other reports from the rendezvous, it being over just yesterday. And protected Florida mangroves are raised for a boat show. This story by Zachary Fagenson, editing by Letitia Stein and Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. New revelations that a long strip of protected mangrove trees were illegally raised amid preparations for the 2016 Miami International Boat Show has outraged Florida environmentalists. The lost trees, critical to the marine ecosystem, were hacked away in mid-May by the Miami City contractor in advance of the five-day show expected to draw 100,000 attendees and 1,500 boats. Environmentalists activists said in a letter to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that staging the show in an environmentally sensitive region would violate a number of federal laws, including the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act. The federal agency is currently weighing permits for the boat show, slated to be held next February at the Miami Marine Stadium. We've got seagrasses, corals, manatees, and all sorts of protected birds, said Myra Pena Lindsay, mayor of nearby Key Biscayne, one of the show's staunchest opponents. The affluent city on an island just outside Miami city limits has hired a public relations firm to demand that the National Marine Manufacturers Association move its event elsewhere. But the city of Miami, which has agreed to replant the trees that could take more than 5 years to grow to full size, continues to support the boat show. It was an isolated incident, said Miami Mayor Thomas Rigaldo. The more than 300 feet of mangroves were raised from a beach abutting the Miami Marine Stadium, a historic yet long-dormant seaside venue that once hosted ocean races and concert performances on floating stages. Nonprofit organizations and the city of Miami have been working for years to revive the stadium, which was shuttered after Hurricane Andrew in 1992. Miami agreed earlier this year to spend $16 million on an extensive overhaul. The boat show, celebrating its 75th anniversary in 2016, also committed several million dollars to improving the structure. Boaters are some of the original conservationists, said Ellen Hopkins, spokeswoman for the National Marine Manufacturers Association. And Colorado sage-grouse conservation plan leaves species at risk of endangerment. To prevent the greater sage-grouse from sliding toward endangerment, the Northwest Colorado Greater Sage-Grouse Final Environmental Impact Statement needs significant improvements to stop habitat loss, according to the American Bird Conservancy. This assertion is part of a comment letter on the Colorado Plan ABC and Prairie Hills Audubon Society, submitted Monday to the Bureau of Land Management. The letter makes science-based recommendations that can be adopted to better conserve the species. The letter states in part that while in many instances the Northwest Colorado Plan marks progress over current management, in some cases does not allow the management recommendation of scientists, leaves open the potential for further habitat loss or degradation, and does not designate protected reserves or focal areas for greater sage-grouse. We urge that the final environmental impact statement be revised to prevent the construction of new transmission lines, oil and gas fields, and roads in priority sage-grouse habitat. The final environmental impact statement reveals that priority sage-grouse habitat in the region is already heavily impacted by a variety of developments. For example, the 926,700 acres of priority sage-grouse habitat, a cumulative total of 857,400 acres, have already suffered or are at significant risk of suffering harmful impacts. These include 40 communication towers, 60 miles of utility corridors impacting 40,500 acres, 10,400 miles of transmission lines right-of-way covering 257,600 acres, 331,500 acres leased for oil and gas drilling, 2,100 miles of road impacting 21,000 acres, 19,400 acres of locatable mineral claims, mineral material disposal sites impacting 21,300 acres, grazing allotments that do not meet land health standards that cover 166,100 acres, and 1,500 miles of fences. Further, oil and gas drilling is expected to expand to include another 1,889 well pads and 5,356 wells to be drilled in priority sage-grouse habitat. In addition, the upcoming oil shale and tar sands programmatic EIS could open up additional priority habitat in Colorado to development. Two transmission line products, Gateway South and Transwest Express, are also being allowed to be built in the under the Colorado plan. These projects have the potential to cause substantial loss of habitat for the grouse. Because sage grouse avoid tall structures, they need to have at least a 4-mile buffer from transmission lines. The effective habitat loss from these two projects could be immense. The Transwest Express project would impact approximately 3,584,000 acres, while the 400-mile-long Gateway South project could impact another 2,048,000 acres. Sage grouse avoid tall structures like transmission lines and communication towers, so new developments need to be located outside of their habitat, said Steve Homer of the American Bird Conservancy. The exemptions for the interstate transmission lines and weak buffer standards for other tall structures threatens to undermine the effectiveness of the plan and would ultimately cause the grouse to be extirpated from those habitats. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and we thank you for listening. You can listen to a rebroadcast of this show on Free Radio tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. If you're in the Moscow, Idaho area, you can listen to 90.3 KRFP Radio Free Moscow Monday nights at 9:30 for the Earth First Update. And you might try going to northbysouthradio.com. That's northbysouthradio, all spelled out, .com. And somewhere on their pop-up radio will be Free Radio, but who knows? northbysouthradio.com was formerly Radio Free Edmonton. And you can always go to radioforall.net. That's the place on the net where shows are archived. Radio, the number 4, all.net, and you can listen there, or you can download this or previous shows. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and freakradio.org. We want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.